raffles, food, an instrument petting zoo, and live music by local student and professional musicians playing genres from classical to Irish to jazz to rock. Again, that's the third annual Northwest Quartet Fest on Saturday, December 7th from noon to 8 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up at 10, KBOO's Tammy interviews Robert Franklin, the manager of the Native American Student and Community Center located in PSU. Robert discusses his life on and off the reservation and how his personal experience has shaped his current position with the NACC. And 11, It's Between the Covers, where host David Naiman speaks with poet Jake Skeets on his debut collection of poetry titled Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers, an examination of toxic masculinity through the lens of a queer indigenous Southwesterner. And now, coming up on Native American Calling, host Tara Gatewood talks with Acoma Pueblo Governor Brian Veo about the tribe's recent victory in regaining possession of the Acoma Shield from an overseas auction house.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. Hundreds of Native items, some of which are sacred, have been stolen from tribes over the centuries. Occasionally, they end up overseas in auction houses. Recently, those included a sacred deer from the Hoopa tribe, a war shirt from the Lakotas, and items from the Hopi Nation and masks from the Navajo Nation. There aren't very many success stories that include tribes getting sacred items back, but the Pueblo of Acoma did. Today, the Acoma Shield, a sacred item that was stolen from the Pueblo, ended up in a Paris auction house, but now it is making its way back to the Pueblo here in New Mexico. And it took years of work from the Pueblo Nation and multiple U.S. government entities. We'll take you through this journey with some of the folks who were instrumental in the legal process, especially when you hear the method that the tribe used and standing their ground, saying we will not pay to have this item come back. And here in Studio 49 with us today is the Acoma Pueblo Governor, Brian Veo. He is here. Welcome, Governor Veo.
Thank you.
And also here, too, is former governor of Acoma Pueblo, Kurt Riley. Our pleasure to have him here. And, Governor, thank you for joining us, too.
Good morning or good afternoon, everyone.
Sure.
Pleasure to be here.
And we air at different times in different places, so it's good to cover all your bases. Also here in studio with us is Aaron Sims. He's an attorney for the Chestnut Law Office and Acoma Pueblo's General Legal Counsel. Our pleasure to have him here. Aaron, thank you for joining us for another one of our discussions.
Kuhatzi haupa. Thank you.
And here in Studio 49 with us as well is John Anderson. He is the United States Attorney for the District of New Mexico. Our pleasure to have him here. John, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And so I gave a really brief run-through of the story of this shield, but let's backtrack and talk a little bit more about what it means to now say that this shield will be returning home. And Governor Veo, I want to start with you. Anything you want to share about just this journey and what it's led to?
Thank you, Tara. Kuatzi hopa, waikaiuta, takai mai matawatsi, straitrash kopa. Thank you for the opportunity to come on the program this morning. There are a lot of emotions today, and it's, you know, we've reached a point in this process where we will actually transport the shield back to Acoma today, this afternoon. And so there's, we do this with great anticipation, and the community is most definitely excited, grateful, and what a perfect time to have this occur during this time of giving thanks. And really that's, I think, at the end of this process and having carefully considered all of the time and work and prayers and sacrifices that have been made throughout this process, that we have this opportunity to embrace our protector and to return it to its home, and to give thanks for everyone who has played a part in this process. It's been difficult. It has required a tremendous amount of time of many people, and we at the Pueblo are very grateful for everyone's efforts. But this also signifies a time in our living history with Acoma always at the forefront on issues around cultural resources protection and repatriation, and our commitment and our need to fulfill our inherent responsibility of ensuring that the culture continues, that this time in our history represents a recognition by us as Acoma people and as Native people and Indigenous people that we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to do more. We have an opportunity to make a difference and impact policy and impact the ways in which the public at large, and maybe more specifically, the collectors and dealers, those within the museum realm, federal agencies who are dealing with these types of issues, that we can be successful if we work together. And that there is an acknowledgement that individual tribes, tribal leaders, their cultural leaders, and the communities that comprise our tribes can really make a significant contribution towards these types of efforts. So we are very grateful today. On behalf of our tribal council and our community at Acoma, we give thanks and look forward to this afternoon's short trip from Albuquerque to Acoma to with the shield.
And Governor Bayo, when you think of here forward, your community will have this missing item, and future generations will not have to start a day knowing that, you know, this part of their culture is somewhere in the hands of someone else or some place where it shouldn't be. Tell me what you are thinking. Here forward, future generations won't have to endure whatever kind of loss or whatever kind of obstacles that have been here. It's going to be gone.
There is a bit of a sigh of relief. But we also, to the issue of our inherent responsibilities in this time, but also in the future. Yes, our children and our grandchildren and those not yet born will continue knowing they have their protector. They will also, I pray, will hold in very high regard this item and use it. Use it in a way that does indeed protect them and our lands and our animals, all living beings. So I believe that our children, who are the beneficiaries really of all of this, are set up to do just that. And like I said earlier, we have a lot of work to do. There's significant language loss. There is, reductions in the ways in which we are communicating and transmitting traditional knowledge. And so we have to make be much more aggressive in the way in which we do that work together and set our children up for that good life ahead.
And all these things connect. And Governor Bayo, you also ask for the privacy of the Pueblo to be respected on this return. And a lot of times, and that makes everyone go, well, why are they saying this? Or, you know, why can't we know? But anything you want to share about that? Of course, you know, that plea of respecting privacy in this return. There isn't going to be a big parade that everybody can line up for and, you know, get a T-shirt to commemorate that moment. This is something more.
It is. And we ask this of the public because it is our time. And this isn't a message that comes from the tribal government. This is a request made by our cultural leaders on behalf of the Shield. And so there's a process that needs to be instituted to welcome the Shield and give it time to re-engage. But it also gives us that time to reflect, because there is a level of trauma that we have realized and experienced as a result of this experience. And so that cultural process of healing, reflection, is the reason why we are asking for the privacy.
And this gets to the heart, and Governor Riley, we will hear your thoughts too about this whole process, but it gets to the heart of, I believe, what has been one of the largest struggles in this whole process is our ability to say, here's a line. This is as much as we are willing to share, and that should be respected. And a lot of times when it comes to all of this, you know, people don't feel there is a line, that if you want something, you need to give us information. And that's something that a lot of our tribal nations can relate to, where they are constantly being forced to cross that line in order to protect their community. And when you get to that point, when you say, you know, that's just not up for public view, that's not up for public knowledge, then sometimes that can create more hurdles. And I'm also curious to Aaron, your thoughts about this when you are looking at the legal side of this, and you know that there are certain items to win a case, you got to present certain information. And John, being on that receiving end of being told, you know, this item is sacred, or this information is sacred, this is as far as we can go. How do you make your decisions, or how are you able to inform the people and levels that you need to in order for things to balance? And I know this is a huge thing that we're really talking about today. And what happens when we stand our ground? What happens when we're told, well, that's not enough information, we can help you? There's a lot there. We're going to continue with this conversation here, but you are also welcome to join us too. Any thoughts, give us a call. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to hearing from you. Bison were hunted to near extinction in the 1800s. Today, there remain scattered herds, many of which are part of determined efforts to revitalize the iconic species. Tribes are playing a key role in restoring bison herds to public and tribal lands. We'll learn more on the next Native America Calling.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects you to unique tools and programs, helps you save money, and tackle the issues that matter most to you, your family, and your community. What AARP does might surprise you, like sponsoring the National American Indian Housing Council Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, December 9th and 10th. Information at aarp.org. That's aarp.org.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we are focusing on the return of a ceremonial shield to the Pueblo of Acoma here in New Mexico. And it was stolen from the tribe and put up for sale as a piece of art at an Eve's auction house in Paris. And you can give us a call to join the conversation. We are at 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Here in Studio 49 with us today is Acoma Pueblo Governor Brian Vio. Also here, too, former Governor of Acoma Pueblo, Kurt Riley. Aaron Sims, legal counsel for the tribe, as well as John Anderson, who is the United States Attorney for the District of New Mexico. Gentlemen, my pleasure to have you here. And Governor Riley, I'm going to turn to you and your thoughts about, you know, what this is all about and that discussion that I mentioned before the break of this has caused a lot of weight. And I think back to that first time you were sitting in this studio with us. I was sitting across from you and we were talking about this issue. And I could see that weight of not knowing what was going to happen and knowing everything that you had been through. And today it seems different. And talk to me a little bit about, you know, that line and what Native people are put through when they're told to disclose very important information that should be traditional knowledge only.
Thank you, Tara. I think that those of us that have not served don't really realize the amount of work that it takes or that it will take or took to get an item such as the Acoma Shield back. It was very difficult to listen to federal agents asking for very detailed information. And it was frustrating for me to be the spokesperson for the tribe, knowing that I did receive counsel from our religious leaders as to the limits of what to say and what I could not say. I think the full realization of that came when I was asked to go to the State Department and try to influence their international cultural unit to find out how, as in this case, this was the first time that the U.S. government was asking to repatriate an item back to the United States. They were so used to repatriating items back to other countries. So this was the first. So they followed their standard format of, can you describe the item in height, color, material? Do you have a picture? What was it used for? So they were using their standard form of trying to identify an item for another country to make sure that it was theirs. Of course, I couldn't answer any of those questions. And it was very frustrating for me as well as for them. So how could we do that? And so we had to, we took this opportunity as an education of Acoma culture. And they suddenly realized how important it was. I hope I did a good job, but what they realized is it was very significant an item to Acoma culture. Even though they didn't have a description of it, based on what I told them that our religious leaders, our historic preservation staff had clearly identified it as being Acoma in origin. They also had living knowledge of its use that they could identify the iconography. You know, so without really, I guess, filling out the form, they realized that, yes, this is Acoma's. And I think for other Pueblo tribes and nations in this country, those steps have to be taken dependent upon your own cultural norms. And it's best to do it now because we never know when these items are going to be missing again. So, but it is frustrating. So I think the conversations that I've had with members of Congress as well as federal agents and federal department staff, it wasn't really a description. It was an education as much as I could of how significant the Acoma Shield was in Acoma culture.
And many of times, all of this in the past has been dismissed. What do you think? It seems in this case, it's different. Any thoughts?
It's different because we had to, as again, it was an education, because even though we've been studied to death, you've heard that before, who are actually the experts of their own culture? It's every Pueblo tribe and nation in this country who continue to practice their language, their culture, and traditions. Sometimes what's written in these books is wrong. I'm not going to say totally wrong, but it is wrong in that it's from the outside looking in. We as cultural practitioners who understand the cultural significance of song and prayer, we can better identify these items. And the work spins out from there, not necessarily from cultural items, but sacred places, the landscape, the land, the water, the resources. You know, it spins from there. And I think that all indigenous people value land, water, wildlife, human beings in its entirety. And so when we have to educate the outside world of how we see things culturally, we are the ones that should be identifying our own cultural resources, such as the Acoma Shield.
Thank you, Governor. And Aaron, I turn to you and just your thoughts, how a lot of this has translated in the courts and your case, and in trying to present information and understanding, there is a limit, or maybe even it's caused you to be even better of a lawyer and more creative of how to present a case. And I can kind of relate to that a little bit in terms of, you know, the work that we do in respecting our indigenous nations, that I know there are those lines, but you can still tell the story. You just got to figure out another way to do it in a respectful manner. Aaron, I turn to you. Go ahead.
Thank you. And, you know, the significance, I think, of this case legally is tremendous, because, and I want to underscore something that former Governor Kurt Riley mentioned in the direction that cultural leaders gave to tribal leadership, but also to us as attorneys working on this, because it was a significant and very difficult decision at the outset to understand what it would take in terms of the disclosure of information and the finding out of information, because we understood that on the legal side, the standard of information we had to provide to give, in this case, the U.S. attorney, the information that he needed to pursue this. And it was a very difficult decision that was made. But I think for Acoma, what has occurred during this process is certainly in the 4 years of this case, as it's gone forward, really a refinement of how we look at these kinds of issues and how we address these kinds of issues from the legal standpoint. And a lot of that is as Governor Riley mentioned, in educating not just on the cultural side, but educating on the legal side to outsiders. And a lot of that comes from trying to have others, people understand that for Acoma, these kinds of items have a very specific set of rules, you could say, about how they are to be treated and held within the community. And under traditional law, it is a violation for them to leave the community. And so a lot of times for these kinds of items, we may not know how they left, but when we see them kind of out in the wild, so to speak, we know something wrong occurred. And that's a notion that we've really tried to, in this process, educate others about, because in addition to the Acoma Shield, during this time, Acoma's gone through the process of identifying a lot of other items from the Pueblo, and have been successful in repatriating a number of other items. And a lot of that has come from this idea in educating galleries, educating individuals, that this left under pretenses that would have violated Acoma law. We might not know exactly how it left, but in the Acoma Shield case, we were fortunate to be able to engage in that kind of investigation to find out how it left. And I think Governor Vaio, and I hadn't really thought of it this way, mentioned something that I think is critical here, and it's absolutely true of even that process, the difficulty of that, and that's always a question people have of, well, how did it leave? A lot of times we may not know, and even going through that process can be traumatic, because the process of finding out how the Acoma Shield left, I think, was, yes, very traumatic for the community and for those individuals that had to kind of relive finding their understanding of how the shield left, and the feelings associated with that. And so that can be a very traumatic thing. But that's part of, I think, all about the education that has come from this process, both on, as former Governor Riley mentioned, on the cultural side, but also on the legal side, in educating the public about this.
All right, thank you for that. And John, I turn to you on that side, the receiving of hearing this kind of information, or hearing, you know, an indigenous nation asserting themselves, saying that this is our sovereign right to protect cultural knowledge, but it is also the duty of the other entities to respect this and honor some of these requests. And so being on that receiving side, how do you process this? Is this something that is groundbreaking that may set a precedent for the future on how the receiving end, the federal side, the, you know, the legal side, is taking a look at these certain kind of issues? Anything you want to share about the receiving end? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, we're obviously very happy to have played some role in returning the Acoma Shield to its rightful home and the people of Acoma, and we're happy with the result that was achieved here. I'm happy to talk about the legal process that went into it, but the message that I really want to come out of this is, I think as Aaron alluded to, one of public awareness of these types of issues and the types of trading that potentially goes on with items of cultural patrimony that are not designed or intended and should not be subject to that kind of exchange. We now have federal statutes in place that are intended to protect items of cultural patrimony and items of Native American cultural heritage, including the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, known as ARPA, and the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA. And it is my hope that the result we have here, the attention that it has garnered, and the legal process that went into it will raise awareness of the types of issues that these statutes are intended to promote, specifically the protection of these items and ensuring that they remain in their traditional cultural homes.
And can you explain a little bit of how NAGPRA came into play? Because we know NAGPRA is a United States, you know, law. Doesn't go beyond borders, but it was used. Can you explain a little bit about how it was called upon in this case?
Well, one of the challenges that we had here was, you know, ARPA and NAGPRA are fairly recent statutes, and that speaks to the fact that these issues are coming to obtain public attention and legislative attention fairly recently. For many years, these issues were somewhat overlooked. So the concern we had here was that these items were, as far as we could tell, removed from Acoma before these statutes came into effect. So we were left to rely on the Antiquities Act in alleging that this item was removed from the Acoma Pueblo illegally. Unfortunately, in this case, we could not rely on those tools of ARPA or NAGPRA, which could be relied upon in an action that was brought for something removed from Pueblo land more recently. But nonetheless, we were able to achieve the goal here, and so I'm hopeful that, that will promote awareness of the types of issues that these statutes are intended to address.
And people who are looking into this or reading about it might see the words forfeiture complaint. Explain that a little and how it played out.
Sure. Well, we filed that's the legal term, a forfeiture complaint. We filed it here in federal court in New Mexico. And we essentially alleged that the item was obligated to be returned to the United States government because it was illegally stolen from federally superintended land, from the Acoma Pueblo. And of course, the government's intention in doing that was to be able to retain possession of it to return it to the Acoma people.
All right. And Aaron, anything to add just to create more awareness, or if there have been misunderstandings in the way the media has reported on this in talking about the legal aspects or even just how the process went down? Anything more you want to add?
I think just to add, I think one of the things to understand is this was a long, long process. When ACMA identified the shield, it first identified the shield in 2015, and literally on the eve of the auction, and there was little that could be done. And really to the credit of when we were ready the next year in 2016, to the credit of the United States Attorney's Office and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Office of Justice Services, and the FBI, they really stepped up to assist the Pueblo in this instance, and it was a critical piece of the work that really we hadn't engaged in before, and hadn't engaged in for a long time, because I think a number of these kinds of cultural resource investigations really probably haven't hit their height like this, or I should say even our referrals to federal investigators about these kinds of issues haven't hit their height like this since probably the early 90s, when statutes like the U.S. Attorney mentioned, like at NAGPRA, were first passed. But it's kind of, I think what we see in this is really a cycle of when these items come to surface. And one of the critical issues moving forward will be to keep an eye on this, and keep tabs on how cultural patrimony is put out in the market. And hopefully at a point in the future, we can have more successes like the ACMA Shield.
And when you mention the market, I think that's something that we definitely should, you know, give a moment to think about why these items are even popular, why, you know, people are willing to pay thousands, millions of dollars for items that are from our own community, and, you know, what the value that they put on it is, as, you know, as we hear from the tribe, and the value they're putting on it. And how much does all of that play into why some of these items move around, or why people are unwilling to give items directly back to a community? We'll get into that here after the break, but if you have any thoughts, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We do look forward to hearing what you're thinking today. Hang tight.
Support by Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute's Early Childhood Education Program, providing an affordable pathway for the next generation of Native teachers who will meet the unique educational needs of Native students. SIPI's Early Childhood Education Associate's degree is an all-inclusive program with mentorship for success in education in an intertribal learning community. Information and application at sipi.edu under Academics, then Programs. Spring application deadline is December 13th.
Thanks for tuning in today here on Native America Calling, and we appreciate any time you tune in. This time when you tuned in, you're hearing one tribe's journey and struggle to have a sacred item return to their community. But the story extends across other tribal nations. We know there are communities that are right now in works to try and get certain sacred items brought back to their community. And maybe you're relating to this because of something that's happening at home. Anything you want to share, 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And I'm going to turn to Governor Vallejo, governor of Acoma Pueblo, who joins us here in Studio 49, among others. And Governor Vallejo, before the break, was talking a little bit about why these things become so popular, and when people get to a point where they feel they own it and expect millions of dollars for it. There's something there, and I know you have also done a lot of work in the area of museums and understand how this process works. And sometimes these things get so popular because they're trivialized and they lose their true meaning. Anything you want to share about, you know, that whole web and how it plays into this, or even why people are seeking out these items?
Well, you know, we can go very far back about how Native American culture and material culture, as a result of early federally managed or mandated initiatives, exposed Native culture. And the interpretation of that was very different from the way in which we acknowledge our material culture, our cultural patrimony. But as a result of that impact and the exposure of culture as a result of early reports like the Bureau of American Ethnology reports that came out, one very detailed report on Acoma, you know, that set the tone for the ways in which Western society would react to the cultures of our people. And they're wanting to know more within their own interests, and also wanting to be engaged with these materials, whether it was pottery, textiles, basketry, jewelry, and unfortunately, our ancestors. The human remains of our ancestors. And so there's a long history of this collecting that has happened. Prior to my appointment as governor, I worked as the director of the Indian Arts Research Center at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, where we steward a collection of about 12,000 items of Southwest art. And within that collection are a number of materials that would be classified as cultural patrimony. It took a while to change the thinking of the institution, and many directors, my predecessors, worked very hard to change that narrative. And the way that was done was to engage source communities and to really refine the documentation associated with these collections, this particular collection. It would be helpful if more institutions throughout the country would do the same. And many, there are some who are working and developing a process for doing just that. But there is a tremendous amount of work that needs to happen, not only within the museum field, but also among dealers and collectors. And clearly within that market, that art market, Native American cultural patrimony is at the top of the list in terms of what's most collectible, what's most desirable, what's most valuable from their perspective. But there is an intrinsic value, there is a cultural value that is most of the time unknown by that community. And that's where the work, I think, needs to be concentrated, is to further advance this conversation and inform and educate collectors. A lot of collectors don't know what they have. And in this case of the Acoma Shield, the consigner of the shield really didn't know what he had. So I think that if NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act, continues to be implemented, where we have the opportunity to repatriate collections of human remains and associated funerary objects and objects of cultural patrimony from institutions within this country, if we can continue with that practice, using that policy, that's good. However, we've not addressed the issue of exportation. And so there is pending legislation, the STOP Act, which is the Safeguard Tribal Objects of Patrimony Act, which is under review and scheduled for a hearing soon within the Senate. This policy would increase penalties of NAGPRA, and it would directly address the issue of exportation. And so while we have been very busy working on the return of the shield to Acoma, we've also been in discussions with the dealer and collector community in the development of this legislation. So I think we're working at a higher level on this, but there are things that people can be doing, the collectors, the dealers, the art markets, the museum community, all of us collectively, I think, can work together to provide more education. And that's going to be so critical moving forward, because it is known that there are still many, many materials, cultural patrimony, that exist in this country and abroad.
In education, is that the reason why the particular collector who was, who on paper was the owner of this shield, ended up deciding to just give it back?
Well, Mr.
Or was it that easy? Am I simplifying something that was more complicated?
It's much more complicated. And I don't know that education was the impetus here for his voluntarily returning the shield over. You know, we had the opportunity to have discussions with him face to face, and at the end of that process, he realized that he needed to do the right thing. He realized that he did not know much about what he had in his possession, and that it was important for it to go back to its rightful owner.
And this relates to many different things and just layers of our indigenous history. You know, what if we start applying some of this to land and how different things would be and the return of land, or even just saying that you own land? Pretty interesting. Governor Riley, I want to turn to you because it is our duty to learn something and pass on lessons. Maybe you're passing on to a lesson to somebody who's listening right now, who is maybe one day going to take steps and be cautious or know what to do when they're faced with some of this. Any thoughts or advice to those who may be going through these steps or just in this process, things you really should know or you should be doing?
Well, I think, as Aaron said, when we first started on this journey, we suddenly realized that we also had to improve our process there at Acoma. I think it was a series of fortunate events during those years that we had already established the Tribal Historic Preservation Office Advisory Board, and their members of the various societies who have all the cultural knowledge combined as much as we have retained all of these years. That's one source that I think other tribes, Pueblo tribes and nations in the country should consider, a well-established cultural advisory unit. The other thing that we realized is it was very difficult to document what happened when the shield was taken. As someone said, you know, this was a very traumatic event for all of us, and I think more so for the caretaker. It's just the shame and embarrassment of being charged with something of value to the community and the realization that it's suddenly gone. But we did go back and we did obtain affidavits. But maybe as a deterrent or at least something helpful, the tribes could consider if it's permissible and to photograph. I know that's a really bad term, a sketch or a drawing, because at least at Acoma, you know, we can't do that. But other tribes may be a little bit more amenable to such things. If not, at least a knowledge of how that object looks like currently is very, very important when it's gone. How to clearly identify an object. In the early stages as well, we turned to the FBI and they told us to call the Albuquerque Police Department. So there was a lot of lack of coordination among federal law enforcement as to who tribes should go to. And we were so lucky that, you know, we had Special Agent Franklin Chavez of the BIA, who is from Kiowa Pueblo. He understood the cultural significance. And so he took it upon himself to really, lay the groundwork of how to reach out to other law enforcement agencies and to really work with them to find out what do you need as far as from the Pueblo of Acoma. So working with law enforcement and developing law enforcement communications is very, very important. Lastly, your congressional delegation is very important as well. I know that the congressional delegation from New Mexico understands Native Pueblos, tribes, and nations in the state. Every time I would go back to Washington, and I'm sure Governor Vio does the same thing, we make our circuits, and we ask for a little push there, a phone call there, a letter there, and it all seemed to work. They have ties that we don't have. They have communication lines that are open to them, especially to Senate or Congressional House side leadership. So all of these things we had to learn along the way. And so I think other tribes are aware now of what should be done. But I think to really solidify it in the process when something goes missing is very, very important now for tribes to consider.
And a lot of coordination. And John, I turn to you because there was coordination among countries. And anything you want to share, lessons learned or important information about even dealing with a foreign country?
Sure, there was. And obviously, we filed our complaint here in federal court in New Mexico. And I paused for a second to recognize the work that many folks in my office did, including Kyle Naback and Steve Kotz and Feather Astor. But once we did that, then we need to invoke really a process that reaches across the ocean to coordinate with the French authorities. And we do that through what's called a Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, or an MLAT for short. And that process requires that really the law in France somehow line up with the law in the United States. In other words, that the French authorities recognize, as U.S. law recognizes, that this item is subject to forfeiture and return to the United States. So we did a lot of work through the DOJ legal attaché in Paris, and it takes longer than we would like. It was expedited somewhat in this case by the identification of the consignor, but any time we are dealing with a foreign country in that kind of legal assistance treaty, the process it doesn't go as quickly as we would like, but in this case we did get it done.
And maybe even something to pique interest of future law enforcement or future legal folks and things that you might want to look into. We are just before the end of the hour, and real quick, any final comments? Governor Riley, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention that I guess over the years we as tribal leaders have limited ourselves as far as understanding our tribal sovereignty. Talking to the French authorities through through the legal process was the first step. One last trip to Washington, and I asked for an audience with the mission of France, and I got in. I was very surprised. I talked to the chief of staff, had a long conversation with her, and at the end of that conversation, she explained to me the difference in government perspective from the French side. The last thing she said to me, she said, "But Governor, you're very convincing." So I think any way that tribal leaders can use their tribal sovereignty and really exercise it is so important in these kinds of circumstances.
And Governor Vaio, I turn to you. By the end of the day, the story is going to change again. The shield will be in possession of Acoma Pueblo. Any closing thoughts?
Well, this morning when I woke up, I realized that over 20 years ago, when I served as the director of the Historic Preservation Office for my Pueblo, I was directly involved in the first repatriation using NACPRA. And here we are today. So this is a process. This is our part of our evolution as Acoma people. And we'll close a chapter, but we open a new chapter filled with opportunity for my community and for Native America. And I'm very excited about that. Thank you.
And real quick, any words in your language to your community?
Tawa ers ahanu temish siyako. Hopa eme etsi umat si shitratna. Niwa namak trotrima. Hausina niwa te skotrima si haizi. Bars ek me unati. Hawena. Stiarskam stiushapumzi. Uts ayumzi trawatani. Come yona. Stiwi stia hawetsi tia. Niwa stiak trotrima hopa. Kai amo shotrima. Tene shotrima hopa. Ta drawi shots.
Thank you very much. That's going to wrap up our program today. Governor Brian Vaio, thank you for joining us. Governor Kurt Riley, thank you for joining us. Aaron Sims, John Anderson, thank you as well. And folks, we do appreciate you tuning in. If there was anything you missed, you can find this in our archives on our website, nativeamericacalling.com. And you can even send your comments still to us there on the website. I'm your host, Tara Gatewood.
Support by the National American Indian Housing Council's 2019 Legal Symposium. The NAIHC, focused solely on improving housing in tribal communities across the country, will present the latest trends in Indian housing and up-to-date legal and regulatory issues, and lawyers can earn continuing legal education credits at Bally's Resort in Las Vegas, December 9th and 10th. Information and registration at naihc.net/legal.
Keshe, open enrollment after in the KC. Packet out now, Gakunala ante motate atuna quat denishuka. Medicare enrollment is December 7th and Anna Asti in the marketplace de on Usana is December 15th and Anna Asti. Asna, Tayu Yanakani and the Yamto Nakwa Abosawa Shuatu. Look at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services don't now open any to look in our way. Elakwa.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network. Oh, hey, yeah.
Program ended with the Acoma Pueblo Song of the Sky. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It is 9:58. Coming up next, KBOO's Tammy interviews Robert Franklin, the manager of the Native American Student and Community Center located in PSU. Robert discusses his life on and off the reservation and how his personal experience has shaped his current position with the NACC. And at 11, it's Between the Covers. Host David Naiman speaks with poet Jake Skeets on his debut collection of poetry titled Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers, an examination of toxic masculinity through the lens of queer and indigenous Southwesterners.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Fake Radio reenacts the historic radio shows the old-fashioned way, dressed in period clothing and standing with scripts in hand in front of old microphones. They'll recreate the 1947 broadcast of Lux Radio Theater's It's a Wonderful Life, including the commercials and announcements. Again, that's It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's It's a Wonderful Life on Saturday, December 7th from 8 to 10:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. ¶¶
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 3rd Annual Northwest Quartet Fest on Saturday, December 7th from noon to 8 p.m. at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver, Washington. The Northwest Quartet Fest is a benefit to raise money for local school music programs. There will be raffles, food, an instrument petting zoo, and live music by local student and professional musicians playing genres from classical to Irish to jazz to rock. Again, that's the 3rd Annual Northwest Quartet Fest on Saturday, December 7th from noon to 8 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Dandy Warhols playing at McMenamin.